Hello, Autism Warrior, and welcome to Barefoot Autism Warriors podcast. I'm Ninka Bernadette Mauritsen, and I am here to tell you that autism is a consciousness test, it's a wake-up call, and it's your chance to turn your life around. And when you do, everything changes. This is probably one of the most explosive podcast interviews I've ever made. Normally, it's only been available inside my membership, but I'm releasing it today because everyone needs to hear this. Autism is not a neurological disease. What? Yes, this family physician says so. How many children with autism have you treated? How many children with autism have you turned into completely normally functioning with no symptoms individuals? Those are the questions that Dr. Mensah asks his colleagues. Not many can say yes, but there are some who do this every single day. You need to know who those people are. But that's not all. You're also going to finally understand what the problem is with the MTHFR test and why the practitioners who use it are not good practitioners. You should run away from them. What is the deal with them? What does Mayo Clinic say about them? What does Harvard say about these tests? What's the problem with methylated B12, methylated folate, folic acid, and more? Why is it that some children act drunk, and why is it that you have to remove certain foods from autistic children's diet? Even if they don't want to eat anything, even if they protest and flap, that is not a reason why you shouldn't change the diet. And you're also going to learn how to do that when your child is protesting. This podcast interview is a must for beginners, it's a must for skeptics, it's a must for professionals working with autism, ADHD, depression, anxiety, and autism moms. It's a must if you're struggling with the diet and making that decision finally to change and remove carbs, remove the sugars, remove the processed foods, if you're dealing with a picky eater. If you want a doctor to tell you a really specifically previously skeptic medical professional to talk to you about these things, this is the podcast interview you have to watch and save and share with everyone. So let's dive in. Welcome to Dr. Albert Mensah, and I'm going to have him introduce himself. This course is for parents that have tried everything and they've been reaching out, maybe tried diets, maybe not, but parents who have children who are out of control, out of reach, maybe have a diagnosis of autism or something like that on the spectrum or not. But what they will have heard is this is for life. This is a brain disorder. This is genetic. There's nothing you can do about it except coping with it. And these parents also, normally they hear that there's no evidence that any lifestyle changes, anything that has to do with nutrition, will make any difference, and that people that tell you that it does are either crazy or just not backed by science. Which is why for parents out there, it is so encouraging, such a experience of hope to meet you, because you are a hardcore scientist. You are an MD. And you were the skeptic yourself. So could you talk about where you were at and why this made sense to you when you finally realized there's an option here? So where did it start for you, Dr. Mensah?
Oh, thank you, Ninka. And it's true. I truly just didn't believe any of this was really realistic or scientific. To make a very long story short, I literally had to be surrounded by individuals who were being treated, and I was there with other practitioners, and I saw these things changing lives. I saw children losing their diagnosis of autism. I saw children and adults with behavioral mood disorders, nearly all of them being corrected to some level or another. The question was to what degree they were being corrected, and many of them, more than 85%, did tremendously well. Several lost diagnoses, and the one thing you can't deny is somebody actually having visible progress. At that point in time, I became a firm believer, and now I preach, I spread the word as much as I can.
And you came from, because you were about to say yes to a very well-paid
traditional position, and someone introduced you to the Walsh Institute and the Pfeiffer Institute. So just to say, you need to see this. And what was your initial reaction when you heard there's something you can do to reverse autism, for example?
Well, the first thing was that the person who introduced me had only been there 1 month at the original Pfeiffer Treatment Center, now closed. 1 month, she saw such tremendous change, she called me. She said, you have to come and see this. And I said, well, how do they do it? And she said, well, nutrients. I said, no, that doesn't work. We're trained this way, that's ridiculous. There's no way that's going to work. I said, come on. But you see, this was one of my extremely close friends who I know was very no-nonsense. She doesn't fall for gimmicks or scams or things like that. And she's very, very sincere. Her heart is in it, her mind is in it. So I could trust her. And I'd known her for a very long time. So I knew there had to be something to what she was saying. She saw something that needed investigation. And so I decided to take a chance. First, I didn't say anything. I just went there to see what was going on because they invited me. And then when I saw all these things going on, I said, this is amazing. This is amazing. Or is it all a fraud? And so I decided to give it a try because I knew I could always go back to that very lucrative job and make a lot of money, or I could see what's going on here and possibly see the most amazing thing that no one really understands, or no one really knows about, and nobody understands is around. So I took that chance, and then the rest is history. We're now here doing the best we can to spread the word. There's hope, there's treatment. Don't let anyone tell you that this can't be done, that this is a lifetime phenomenon. It is not. It's only a lifetime phenomenon for those who don't know how to treat it, like anything else. Yeah. If you saw an airplane for the first time in your life and somebody said you could fly that, you would say, no, I couldn't, unless you were taught how.
Exactly.
So let's not say these things are not treatable. They are very treatable.
And so I know, as a mom, I know because I went down that track, and I have a child who went from infantile autism to and what I hear as a mom of a recovered child is, well, then he wasn't diagnosed, it was the wrong diagnosis in the first place. So he was diagnosed in a very estimated, very respected psychiatric hospital in Denmark by very experienced staff, and he was all the classical symptoms: stimming, no eye contact, no physical contact, screaming, tantrums, didn't sleep at night, spitting, biting, violent, apathic, could, you know, sensory overload. He had everything going on. What is happening when parents get this diagnosis and they go into this whole system of psychiatric diagnose tools, and what do we need to tell these parents when they're introduced to this system?
The first thing is that you're going to get very similar commentary, Ninka, unfortunately, as to what it is that you encounter. Many practitioners don't know. And see, this is medicine. If we don't know how to treat something, quite often we say there's either no treatment or we say it's untreatable because it's so far off of our radar, off of what we understand, that it simply couldn't possibly be treatable. And that's a very, very wrong and a very, very arrogant kind of a discussion in medicine, because that presumes that we know everything there is to know, and we know for a fact that it's not a treatable condition, which is absolutely wrong. The fact is, most of us on this entire planet don't know that autism is treatable, and we don't know how to treat it. Yeah. Although we do understand as physicians and scientists that there is a way, we just don't know what it is yet. Now, in other respects, what that means is that the person you're speaking to is not a scientist or a practitioner who is familiar with how to treat the condition. The condition is treatable. It's just not something that you can give a pill to, and it's not something that you can just give a drug to, and then it fixes itself. But understanding the scientific background step by step by step by step all the different systems that are involved, or at least the major systems involved, in any individual person, that's where you begin. Mm-hmm. So when someone tells you this disorder is untreatable, well, the first thing you say is, you just don't know how to treat it. Now, don't tell the doctor that. This is what you need to understand. You don't take your car to a repair station and hear the words, this car can't be fixed. You would say, well, of course it can be fixed. I just have to go find somebody who knows how to fix it.
Yes.
Okay. Because everyone knows cars are fixable. Maybe you just don't want to spend the money if it's a big expense. But nonetheless, the analogy is this. It is treatable. When someone tells you that it's not, it just means they don't know how. They are not familiar. But there are many practitioners who understand how to treat this disorder, or at least understand enough to get your child some really good benefit. Those are the people you have to find. And unfortunately, it's not always easy, but they're there.
It's not easy because there's not a lot of them. And we'll get into what it is that you need to make sure that this practitioner knows, and what kind of training this practitioner has had, what not to do, absolutely not to do, which almost every alternative practitioner will do when they meet you and want to help you with your child. Out of the best of interest, but also without knowing what to do, they can make this whole situation worse. What is your background? Because another thing that we will hear as parents is, this is a neurological disease, and it's probably just the fact that you've got more structure in your everyday life that has made him feel better. He's probably still autistic. So you have a background in neurology. What do you say when you hear this is a brain disorder and there's nothing you can do?
Well, that's a great question. And it's not a simple answer. The brain is affected, but so is the GI tract. The gut is also affected. Inflammation is also systemic. Oxidative stress hits every single cell in your body. These are all pieces to the puzzle. It's not simply a neurological disorder. As a matter of fact, it's not neurological in many senses of that word. It may involve brain functioning, but there's a difference between brain function and neurology. Neurology is hardwired. It is the actual structure of the brain and how it affects or how it is affected. But with autism, there's an entire synergy of the entire human system, everything from chemical abnormalities to oxidative stress and inflammation. Inflammation produces edema. Edema surrounds the cells and makes it hard for cells to get the very nutrients they need to survive and thrive and heal and repair. All these things are related. Gut issues create malabsorption. If you can't absorb foodstuffs, you can't break them down into the nutrients that your child needs. In addition, there are oftentimes creatures like yeast or different bacterial organisms that can line the gut, create more inflammation, create hypoglycemic tendencies, which can now lead to mood issues for your child. All these things come together to create your particular child. Now, each child is different. Each child with autism is unique. But understanding what to look for in these general systems is very, very important and key. So it is not a neurological disorder. Neurological disorders are where the primary problem exists in the structure and the connection of the cells in the brain. This is a multi-systemic phenomenon, and that's something everyone needs to understand.
And if you've had a child in your home with autism, you know there's something wrong with the gut. You can look at their skin and see that skin breaking out on a regular basis. They never sleep. They have all these sensory overload symptoms. They have so much physical going on with them that I ask these experts, do you think it could be something he's eating that's affecting him as well? And they said, absolutely not. This has nothing to do with diet at all. Just to get this out of the way, because that's something that you normally hear from critics, what training have you had? Because you're not a PhD or someone who's taken an alternative medical training. You are a hardcore doctor. Can you talk about what your specialty has been up to meeting?
Well, my specialty is very interesting. In fact, our progression is very interesting. I'm what we call a family practice physician, which means not a generalist, but a specialist in multiple areas. So we are held accountable in our training for obstetrics, for gynecology, for pediatrics, for psychiatry, for neurology. The vast majority of specialties, we are required to understand a good 80% thereof. So while we're not as neurological as the neurologist, we can speak their language. And this makes us very uniquely capable to see and understand children, because we've treated children, we've understood how to treat children, we've been trained to treat children from the very beginning. So now when we gain this new understanding about conditions like autism, we can not only apply it to your child, we can look back to see how your child began. In other words, in utero, what might have been happening. And then we can take and age the child to when they're a teenager. So when we're treating the child, we're looking at past, present, and future. Not the child anymore, but even the adult. And so in our specialty, we actually have a great breadth of variety and variation in our training so that we understand male, female, young and old, and we can apply all of that knowledge, all of that background to any individual who has autism at almost any age, whether it's a male or female. So if there are gynecological issues, we can see how gynecological challenges can affect an autistic child or a teenager, if you will. We can see how gut issues can affect, you know, the male. We can see how anything almost in traditional medicine, how that's going to specifically affect your child because we have that kind of a varied background. But now we take that as a foundational base and we recognize one of my very important specialties was in psychiatry and neurology. I always enjoyed the human brain for whatever reason back in medical school. I had no idea I would be doing this. But now the training in family practice incorporates all of those things. So now we can see from biochemical analyses and all these other analyses how it impacts the cognition, the processing, and the development of the human being from start to finish. So we have a little bit of an interesting background, but you know, my business partner, Dr. Judith Bowman, we're both family practice physicians. So we share that similar background and that similar love for the human brain. But most importantly, we have a tremendous compassion and a very soft spot for children. And that's what makes this so important. Who can sit back and say, you know what, here's a child, somebody's future, somebody's hope, and then turn around and say, there's no hope for your child, just leave it this way.
Yeah.
Ninka, I remember very recently, I just had a conversation with a colleague, a doctor, who sits in another continent, I'm not going to say where. He had a friend who told him about this process, and he said, I don't believe it. Now, his son is autistic, newly diagnosed. And my friend called me and said, I'd like you to talk to this doctor. He's a hardcore scientist like you were, but he does not believe this works. And I said to him, listen, one of the things that's very important, I look at every child like they're my child. And if I just had a beautiful son who's now 3 years old, who was diagnosed, I would turn over every leaf possible and I would not stand for the idea that my child's future would never be what it is that I hoped or dreamed. And this is based upon scientific fact. I spent quite a few hours talking to my colleague, explaining to him the science behind how this could happen. But it also told him he had to let go of old past paradigms that said that this was not treatable. And when I train doctors around the world, one of the few things that I do say is, you know, you always hear something can't be done until it's done.
Yeah.
You always hear that something is this way until you find out it's that way. Because everyone out there, you know, the world is flat, right? Everyone knew the world was flat until we found out it wasn't. And that's the only one of my little witticisms I'm going to say right now. But I wanted to share that story with you, Ninka. Very recent. By the way, the doctor turned around, called my friend, and said, let's do everything for my son.
Oh, thank God. Thank
when
God.
That doctor sees the results that his son goes through, because he's at a great age for treatment, he's going to be a very different person. I hope he'll be joining me in preaching this all over the world.
That's an interesting point, because I experience parents, there's two different kinds of people in this field, parents and experts, and there's one side who says, can't be done, don't try to treat me, you're making me feel like a horrible parent. So it feels like an accusation being presented with the idea that there's something you could have done. So this often happens if you have an older child, a teenage child or an adult, or adults with autism get very angry when you say that.
Sorry, I'm losing you in the connection a little bit here. Could you just repeat that, please?
Yes, so do you ever come across, because I meet a lot of parents who get angry when I tell them that there's something you can do, especially if they have older children and they haven't had the chance to change the diet, or they can't make that decision because it's a massive commitment. They resist it like the plague, and they want it to not be true because then there would have been something they could have done. So
yes.
Do you come across that as well in your practice?
Oh, yes. And it's not just older children, some of the younger children. You know, you said the words perfectly, Ninka. It is a massive commitment. Massive. Especially if the major issues are with the gut in the child. Dietary control is very, very strict. How many times have I heard in our practice, you know, my children only likes these chicken nugget things.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
They won't eat anything else. And I tell them, listen, if your child is hungry enough, they will eat what you give them. You
yeah.
are in control, not your child. But you have to be stubborn enough as a parent to say, this is what you're going to do. And I know the children will start to flap. They'll start to get angry. They'll start to rage. They'll start to do a variety of things. But I want you to think about how your child could be different and how you won't have to go through so much of that if you do correct the diet. It's a fabulous start, and we have to be really more stubborn as parents to change things like diet. We have to be really willing to make that kind of a commitment, because it's not just the food that we're eating. The food we're eating affects creatures that are lining the gut, like yeast. And when yeast begin to grow, they produce toxins that affect how your child's brain is going to function. They also produce toxins that actually change and weaken the gut barrier. So now issues regarding absorption and hypoglycemia and inflammation begin. That inflammation doesn't just stay in the gut. It goes to the brain as well. So there's a lot that's there when you start talking about diet. And it is a very, very hard thing to do. And I know parents, it's extremely difficult, but you need to try your best.
So let's dive into the things that are often missed when looking at these children, and why that is a evidence in itself that lifestyle, nutrition, and diet does make a difference. You talked about yeast. Why is it that these children who eat often a lot of junk food, bland foods, crackers, nuggets, candy, whatever, why is it that you compare this to beer brewing in the belly, and what must be changed to get these children to a better place when it comes to that aspect, yeast in itself?
Hey, this is Ninka. I'm just here with a short message for you. If you're listening to this and you're thinking, this needs to be me, I want to turn my child's symptoms around. I want to work with the best practitioners, but I also want to become an expert myself. I work with these practitioners, and I work with the best practitioners in the world. And in my opinion, there are only two. One of them is teaching inside my membership. It's not Dr. Mensah from this interview, but it's one of his colleagues who are at similar level here in Europe. And if you want to learn what I did, walk in my footsteps, do exactly what I did for my child, and learn how to become an expert in methylation, in turning autism symptoms around with you as the leader of that journey, go to barefootautismwarriors.com and download one of my freebies, or send me an email, contact@barefootautismwarriors.com to get started and to talk to me about how you can begin this process. The reason why I always ask people to send me an email is that's how I get rid of the moms that I know I can't help. Because if you don't have the initiative to press pause, go and write that email right now, I won't be able to help you. Because what we are going to change over the next 12 months for you to turn these symptoms around is going to demand so much more from you than sending me an email. So if you're procrastinating on that, I'm sorry, I'm not the one for you. You got to go and find someone else to help you, because I need that level of initiative from you before I want to take you on. And I certainly hope that you have it. If you do, I'd be so thrilled to work with you and teach you all the things that I've learned over the past 16 years. Now back to the podcast.
Well, I want people to understand the level of intensity of the problem. If you go out and have several beers and you're inebriated, you're drunk, you know that this is not functional. You can get thrown in jail for doing the wrong things when you're drunk. You can't make proper decisions when you're drunk. You can't perceive the world properly. For many people, the room spins. You're off balance. You can't walk properly. You can't walk straight. You can't do anything. You can't think. You can't process. You can't go to work when you're intoxicated. I think we all understand that picture. But now, what many people don't understand is that if you take a flask of water, and then you add sugar to it, and you add yeast to it, and let it sit there, sooner or later, the yeast are going to start to ferment alcohol, okay? Now, your gut, or the gut of a child, is about 27 winding feet of flask. And when you eat carbs, sugars, starches, that is the sugar that eventually gets made that goes into that tube filled with water, and a little bit of yeast is all it takes before the yeast start to grow, and now you have a child that is fermenting alcohol. Your children who are having these kinds of diets are living, they're functioning with a certain level of intoxication. So yes, we have theatrically drunk children. Not because they drank wine or alcohol, but because they're actually producing it from their gut. Now, how can these children function clearly? How can they think? How can they perceive? How can they behave? How can they walk? How can they not get extremely excited over the wrong stimuli? How can they not function properly if they're actually intoxicated? So it's not a simple thing of taste. The children are not eating these foods simply because it tastes good. The fact is that the yeast in the body sends signals to the brain telling the child, this is what you need to eat because you'll like it. And then the child eats it because what happens is that when they eat it, the yeast sends a signal of pleasure to the brain of the child. But the other side is that now the yeast begin to grow and multiply more. And the more they grow, the more they send these signals that tells the child to eat the wrong foods, so that the child can basically ferment more alcohol, become more intoxicated, and then you're wondering why your child can't sit still, can't pay attention, can't focus, can't work on tasks, why they're not getting better. You're doing all these wonderful treatments and therapies, but they still haven't gotten better the way they should be. Well, if you haven't addressed the gut, if you haven't addressed the yeast problem that may be present, and your child is still loving carbs, still loving McNuggets, still loving all the starches and the crackers, well, you still have a yeast problem that is uncorrected.
Yes.
And that is a huge problem.
So important. And just simply because for us, we did the hardcore version. So we just got rid of everything, everything. So all the children had was berries, meat, fish, eggs, nuts, vegetables. That was it.
You mean, Ninka, Your children ate the way nature designed them to eat?
crazy, I know.
Is that what you're telling me?
Yes. That and my son was, it was like seeing an addict withdrawal. He went into a flat spin, his pupils were dilated, and he didn't eat for days. And I thought, this is going to just kill me. But, you know, I started to arrange fruit in nice colors and vegetables and cut animals out of the food, and all kinds of creative things that I could do. Eventually, he started picking at it. And that was the first day of the rest of our lives without all these things. And that was a very major step into getting him back to eye contact and out of these tantrums that was destroying our family in a way that we couldn't ride a car together, for example. So if you go out 3 o'clock at night, I never do anymore, but if you look around and see all the fights and the tantrums and the irrational behavior, that's what's going on. So that was
good for you, Ninka. You're a stubborn mother. Wonderful.
And you meet a lot of those, I know. So that was yeast. Another issue that's often missed, and this is not just in the established medical society, this is very much in the alternative practitioner society as well, under methylation and over methylation. What is this? How is it tested? And what do you do when you see children so that you make sure that that's covered as well?
Well, understanding, once again, the science around autism is firstly important. What is very, very important is that most children with autism are undermethylated. Now, methylation is a process. It is a process whereby certain molecules we call methyl attach themselves to enzymes, to hormones, to neurotransmitters, even to your DNA. When they attach, they're like a light switch or a switch. They turn on systems or they turn off systems. Now, if you don't have enough of these molecules that regulate your system, you're called undermethylated. You have to now provide the proper amounts and dosages, so to speak, of these particular agents in order to help the system function properly. What is challenging is that many practitioners out there do not understand methylation very well. They've been told the wrong things, and they now believe that folic acid is one of the keys to treatment, or methylated
folate. Yeah.
Or even folinic acid. The fact is, for most of the children in the autism community, that actually makes them worse. Because you see, any of those elements we just talked about actually steal more methyl away from the system than they provide. So they may donate a little bit here, but then they take away far more. So think if you were with your last bit of money, say your last, forgive me, American currency, your last dollar. And somebody says, you know what, I'm going to give you a dollar. And you say, that's great. But then I'm going to take 10 away from you. Okay. That's not very good because you only had one to begin with. But that's how mistakes like folic acid happen. One of the major universities here in America has stated now that they believe that using extreme amounts of folic acid or even folic acid in general may be a cause of autism. So understand.
Which is crazy because right now it's being fortified into food. So cereal, bread, and all kinds of different foods are now being, the folic acid and is now being added to it. And it's in every multivitamin.
Absolutely, absolutely. There is hope though, Ninka, there's hope. We actually started seeing that some multivitamins are now multivitamins without folic acid. These are areas, companies that are now at the forefront because they understand there's a problem. And yes, we have the same issues here. Breads and cereals and all sorts of foodstuffs are being fortified with folic acid. You have to stay away from them, okay? You do.
What about during pregnancy is what women often ask. So do we not even take it during pregnancy?
Pregnancy is, now this is, don't go quoting me for it because everyone is different. You have to talk to your primary obstetrician. However, every doctor knows you only need folic acid for the first trimester. To be safe, we at Mensa Medical typically talk about the first 4 months when you actually know you're pregnant. So you find out today you're pregnant, and they say you've been pregnant for 2 or 3 weeks. Well, no, today is your first day of pregnancy. And now you continue to take your folic acid, we like to say for about 4 months. So beyond what would be your first trimester, just to be safe. Because then what we suggest is that you don't know the methylation status of your child. So we tell you, don't take folic acid at those kind of dosages anymore. That can be problematic, because if you continue, you might be taking the necessary methyl away from the child, creating undermethylation, and it's possible that could be contributing to autism.
And that's okay. It's really important to understand this, because one of the things you've said as well is this whole craze of green juicing, so a green juice every day. Now all the babies are getting that as well. We have a very strong trend for veganism, eating loads of greens every day, greens as supplements. What is your message to parents who go on that trend and this rise in autism? What's the correlation? What do we need to be aware of?
Well, first of all, I don't want to get a lot of emails or messages from people who have, you know, very strong personal beliefs about whether to eat meat or not to eat meat. I want you to understand my discussion is purely about the science. It doesn't matter what any one of us believes, our bodies work in a certain way. And you can't change that, not yet. So I'm speaking purely scientifically. We know that a big problem with undermethylation is that individuals who eat lots of dark green leafy vegetables, they're rich in folates. So now you can remain a vegetarian, but you have to sit down and ask yourself, I can't eat foods that are rich in folates during a pregnancy, because that could be problematic. So you have to alter your style of dietary consumption. You just have to work harder to find those foodstuffs that aren't rich in folic acid. It doesn't mean that you now have to go out and kill, you know, a wildebeest or, you know, a giant cow and then devour it. We're not saying that. What we're saying is watch out for foods that are high in folic acid, that if you eat too much of it, it becomes as though you're actually taking medication that is rich in folic acid. So that's where the caution comes in with vegetarianism and veganism.
Yeah, so balanced diet doesn't mean that you never eat greens. It means that you don't go on any extreme diets, but be balanced.
Correct.
About your food intake. Don't exclude anything, basically, except gluten, dairy, junk food, and damaged food.
Correct. Stay away from the processed foods and the junk food.
Yes.
Absolutely.
Next thing you'll hear in the alternative world is, what about MTHFR, and shouldn't I be taking a methylated form of B complex?
Okay. First of all, I'm on record, have been, and always will be on record as saying the MTHFR is not an accurate test for undermethylation.
No, we have seen
plenty of, first of all, it's not just Dr. Mensa saying this, okay? I want you to understand this. A little known university known as Harvard University in the United States, a little clinic known as the Mayo Clinic in the United States, have stated that undermethylation is not reflected by the MTHFR test. It is not accurate. And the treatment is not only not accurate, it doesn't work. For the vast majority of people who go through the treatment that they recommend based upon this test, people don't get better. So I always say, listen, if somebody's not getting better on the treatment you're providing as a physician, it means you either have the wrong treatment or the wrong diagnosis or the wrong understanding. And we've seen thousands of people bring us MTHFR tests and say they're not getting better. In fact, many of them got worse. If they were lucky, they didn't get worse. They just stayed not better. So we already know, not only in the research and the science, that test is not accurate. We know secondarily that the treatment, if you are undermethylated, is not folic acid. Because we understand folic acid steals methyl from your body. So that's like saying, once again, and okay, you're on fire, but now you want to take methylated folate, meaning you want to take a little bit of petroleum, throw it on the fire before you try to put it out. Who would do that? That makes no sense. The simple way of putting it is that the vast majority of people who use this test and who prescribe things like methylated folate for it do not understand methylation the way they're told. Now, it's not their fault. They're being told by the labs that this is what's right. Exactly. They're being told by certain individuals who are so-called experts, but the fact is it's not correct. And I simply stay with the idea here is, if your child isn't getting better, if you're not getting better, then how can that be the correct treatment?
Do you then do you recommend methylated B12 or the P5P form of B6? Is that a whole separate conversation?
No, methyl B12 is for people who are under methylated. There are people who are over methylated and they do not need methyl B12. That's the last thing they need.
Exactly.
See, the MTHFR test, to go back to that, Ninka, MTHFR doesn't even take into account overmethylation.
No, I know.
Okay? Yeah. You can't diagnose overmethylation, and 30 to 40% of people with any kind of psychiatric disorder or challenge are overmethylated. Can now, that's not the case in autism.
So
sorry.
Before people get too confused, the most common signs of undermethylation?
That's very interesting. In the typical person, severe perfectionism is one of the most powerful signs that somebody's undermethylated. People who are very rule-oriented, they like to dot the I's, cross the T's. They're very, very deliberate, very meticulous, very, very, very precise. They're usually very bright people. They love academics in general. They usually do very well in school, and they have a family history of high achievement. Now, it doesn't mean overmethylators are dumb. Quite the opposite. Overmethylators are extremely brilliant people, but they're very creative individuals. They look at a problem from 360 degrees in the opposite direction, and they attack it from many different directions. People will sit back and say, that was brilliant. How did you ever come up with that idea? He said, well, I started with a different outlook. I started from a different perspective as opposed to the typical rules. Now, with autism and ADHD, for example, individuals who are undermethylated tend to have very poor focus and poor attention capacity, okay? They tend to have severe anxiety, very high risk for depression, very high risk, okay? But the whole idea of now being very rigid, you know your children with autism don't like change. They don't like to see anything different. They can be in the back seat of your car. If you go down the wrong way, a different way to go home, they get excited in a very negative way. They can start to scream. They can fight until you get back on the road that they understand and are familiar with. So when it comes to autism, that undermethylation is very powerful because it makes it very hard and very difficult for them to change. What is change? Trying to introduce new foods. Ninka, trying to get them to the right foods. Trying to get them into a new situation. Trying to get them to the airport. Trying to get them to the train. Anything that is a new experience is very, very difficult and challenging. And that's one of the very difficult parts or pieces about undermethylation.
And how do you test? So we mentioned yeast, and now we have mentioned undermethylation. One of the things that's challenging for parents right now is the art of testing is one thing. The art of coming up with a protocol and continuously getting these children to a better place, that's what you would almost call forensic work. It is so individual and it requires skills. So how do you test it, and why is it important not to just go to some random practitioner to get help for your child?
I caught the first part about how do you test it. I'm sorry, could you please repeat what you said after that?
Yeah, so how do you test for undermethylation? We mentioned yeast and undermethylation, and why is it such a skill to take this test and get a child to a better place so that you can't just go to any random practitioner? You need to understand how to create a protocol and to have an organic protocol that changes with this child's progress.
Yes. First of all, the appropriate testing or the one of the best first tests to get is a whole blood histamine test. Whole blood histamine. Now, that's the very simple answer to that question. The second question is a little bit more difficult because people don't understand
this is not nutrition. It's nutrient therapy, meaning you're using the natural elements to treat. It is a science more complicated than most other sciences that we understand, because there's still so much to learn about it. So you don't go to an obstetrician to perform brain surgery. You don't go to a urologist or a kidney specialist if your problem is sitting there with the eye. You have to find the right specialist. And these are specialty programs with specialty problems that require a specialist's attention. A generalist, somebody says, well, you know, I read this on the internet and I think we can do this. We'll test for this. You know, it was scary. I went to speak recently to a convention of physicians and somebody asked, well, how do you use a certain test? Somebody else asked the question, once you got those results, how many of you knew what to do with the test? There were only two hands that went up out of a room of 200 doctors. I'm not slamming doctors, of course not. I'm a doctor. They were there to learn, so they were doing the right thing. But what I'm sharing with you is that you have to find the right specialist. In order to do that, you've got to ask the right questions. How many children have you treated? The next question, how many children have you successfully treated? And someone may ask you, what does success mean? Well, be very blunt. How many children have you turned from autism to being normal individuals? I can tell you that there are good practitioners walking this earth that have done exactly that and who do it consistently. If you do not have one of those practitioners, keep looking.
Yes. And what are the questions you need to ask a practitioner that will call them out if they are not the right one? So if they don't answer if they can't answer this question, you need to walk out, because this can actually, you can get a child to a worse place. Many people think, okay, supplements are safe, and if a supplement is good for my kid, more is better. Whereas it's actually almost the opposite, that more is worse than lacking in some cases. So what are the five questions or whatever you think would be good to answer a practitioner when you invest in them, because they are expensive?
You've already mentioned a few. We've talked about a few. The first one is, number one, what is your experience? Okay. And with regard to that, you know, how many children have you treated? How many children have you treated successfully? What do you think is actually going on with my child? Well, the obvious answer is, well, my child has autism. Your child has autism. No. What aspect of autism do you think is actually something that we need to investigate first, second, third, fourth? What would be your plan? Question number five, what would be your plan around how to treat my child? You've spent time with my child. You've had a chance to assess. What do you think are the parameters? What are some of the key pieces you think are happening with my child? Because each child is an individual. So now if your practitioner is there with you and spends time with you, they should have some idea of what it is they want to do. If they're saying, well, you know, we generally do these kinds of tests, that's fine. So what happens if this is wrong? If they say, well, let's take this nutrient product, okay? So then you're saying, well, one size is supposed to fit all. How does this help my child? What if you find out that the chemistry doesn't go along with some of the elements in this bottle? See, this is about specificity. It's not about generalities. So looking at how practitioners will approach your child is very, very important from that perspective. If a practitioner doesn't have answers for you, you need to look somewhere else. I can tell you that the best practitioners are willing to explain to you not only how they're going to do what they're going to do, but why they're going to do what they're going to do and how these issues affect your child. They may talk to you about autism in general. That's what we do. We'll talk about autism in general, and then we'll speak specifically about what it is that's going on with your child. And so do the colleagues that we know around the world who are fabulous in terms of doing this. There are not a lot of them, but there are those who will give you those kind of answers. And you have to be willing to say, okay, that's fine. Maybe I'll go and think about it, if that's the pleasant way you want to leave the office because you're not comfortable. Or you'll say, well, you know what, this has been very interesting. We have many very, very powerful parents, Nika,
who even come to our office, and one of them is not convinced. And they weren't convinced when they got there. And they'll say, well, you know, I think I want to think about it. And then somebody says to them, listen, we're going to do it. And then you can think about it later. but that's because we provide answers to questions. So number one, any good doctor, quite honestly, from my perspective, any good doctor in any field should be willing to answer questions that you have. This is your life. This is your child's life. Do not be afraid to ask questions, and don't settle for no answers. If somebody's not willing to give you answers, go find someone else.
And what you're doing now is something that's been needed, I think, for 20 years, is putting it into a system, an algorithm, all this knowledge that you've been collecting for decades, so that doctors can access this. Because this is something that will take 5 years to get just a superficial understanding of all these different mechanisms that are intertwined. So we will talk more about that later on, but just also to bring some hope, this will make it accessible for more doctors and for parents. But on the back end of that, what is something you absolutely should not do to help these children, which I think most parents would do automatically? One is we already mentioned multivitamins, because there can be elements in there that will make it things worse. Another thing was folic acid. What about copper, pyrodesulfur, and the multivitamins often contain copper, and loads of the healthy foods that contain copper? What do we need to know?
Copper. Let's be purely scientific for a moment. We need to look at the relationship between copper and behavior. Copper takes a neurotransmitter, a brain chemical, called dopamine, and it pushes it to become something you don't want, adrenaline. Mm. You want your child to calm down? Don't give them copper. You want your child to be sane and normal and pleasant? Don't give them copper. Now, there's been a lot of discussion, Nick, I'm glad you brought this up. There's been a lot of discussion about bioavailable copper on the internet.
Yes.
And people are rushing out to give people bioavailable copper. Guess what you're doing? You're actually rushing out to give individuals adrenaline. And you're wondering why your child either doesn't improve or gets worse. Copper is not something you give to a person who's got anxiety, depression, mood dysregulation, behavior disorders. That's like giving somebody a drug of adrenaline, okay? It is not a good idea. And as we're talking just about autism, I'm saying, once again, you're right, Nika. Copper is in multivitamins. It is in a lot of general constructs that people want to take. It's in a lot of foods. Pecans, and when I talk to females who've got depression, bless their hearts, what do I hear most often? I love my chocolate. I love my almonds. I love my pecans. I love all these things.
And that's the whole thing, because that's, again, the health trend is we replace dairy with loads of almond milk and bread baked on almond flour or pecan flour. And then this is actually a lot of copper in a day if you then add chocolate and raw cacao nibs, all that stuff. And then loads of women have the IUDs, what they call them.
Oh, before you go to that, many vegetables have high copper.
Yeah.
Spinach, broccoli, high copper. They're good in one area, namely cleaning your bowels and keeping them healthy, but now can produce not only adrenaline, but also migraine headaches. Okay. This happened to my sister. I'll be very honest with you. She had migraine headaches for years. Her naturopath found out that she was actually allergic to spinach. I believe that copper also had something to do with it, because copper can create migraines. So be careful, be cautious about too much of anything. Sorry, Nika, go right ahead.
Yeah, no, that's just so interesting, because we think we do the right thing, and also for our kids, and we don't understand, well, I did remove dairy and there's no change. Maybe look at the copper-rich foods in the diet. How is that? So that's one thing. Just to recap, you test for yeast, you test for methylation under or over. and you test for copper to zinc ratio, because what is it with copper that has an effect on these children when it comes to the zinc copper ratio in B6?
Okay, I want to first get away from this whole idea of zinc copper ratios. It gets a lot of people into trouble. I want you to consider that, yes, there's a relationship. Zinc and copper are like cousins who don't like to talk to each other, okay? There is a relationship between them, but in reality, they do different things. They do things on their own. The key is to recognize if you have high levels of copper, it has to be treated.
Yeah.
If you have low levels of zinc, it has to be treated. Don't worry about the ratios. That's not the issue. Copper by itself with normal zinc is a big problem. High levels of copper with decent amount of zinc is a very big problem. Normal levels of copper with low levels of zinc is a big problem. But if you've got normal copper and low zinc, you don't increase them both, you're going to put someone in the hospital. I've seen it happen. I didn't do it.
What happens then?
There was a practitioner in the United States. One of my patients moved to another part of the United States. And she didn't have a lot of capacity. So she went to see someone local who was supposedly a natural person. And they saw that the person, that our patient was low in zinc. And they believed you had to have a 1-to-1 ratio between copper and zinc. So they gave them 50 milligrams of zinc. And then they gave them 50 milligrams of copper. I'm not exaggerating. Our patient called us from the emergency room of the hospital with heart palpitations, severe anxiety, panic, and depression. They thought she was going to be put in the psychiatric ward. It was the copper. Do not worry about ratios. Do not give copper.
No. Nope. Okay?
That is not the key.
Thank you.
So I want to clarify that, Ninka. The ratios are not as significant. What is important is to look at them individually. Low zinc, correct the zinc. High copper, bring it down. Don't worry about the ratios. And this is what I share with all the doctors when we're training them, okay? Most important thing.
Love it. And we're going to provide a download sheet for how to get tested and where. So don't worry if you're thinking, oh, I need the test, I need the protocols. You will be guided towards who to go to, what to do step by step. So one last thing that I know you're testing for as well is pyrrole disorder, which seems to be more and more common, and strangely enough, no one talks about this. And when there's a pyrrole disorder, either genetically or just acutely, the much beloved fish oil is not a good idea. And most parents would give children fish oil just by default. So what's the deal?
Well, whenever you've got disorder in a system, there's usually a ramification for it. So when you've got disorder at a chemical level, like pyrrole disorder, the process, the pathway by which omega-3 oils move in the system that lead to fighting inflammation, there's a problem there, and it doesn't work that way. Instead, they move through a pathway that now leads towards inflammation, not correcting inflammation. So omega-3s, fish oils, if you are someone who has pyrrole disorder, omega-3s will actually make you worse, not better. They actually create inflammation. They're not anti-inflammatory at that level, especially if you've got a very strong pyrrole disorder, okay? What tends to happen is that you need more omega-6s than you do omega-3s. Now listen, it doesn't mean you can't eat fish, okay?
No.
It doesn't mean that you can't have a wonderful relationship, fish twice a week, and so forth. What it means is that you don't take fish oil supplements. You can get your omega-3s through your diet,
yes,
but you must supplement with omega-6s.
The right omega-6,
your doctor will tell you about.
Evening primrose oil, for example.
Yes, evening primrose oil is an example. Orage oil is another example. The nuances between the two, let your doctor guide you with that.
Yes.
Okay? Because there are differences. Okay. But you don't routinely just give children. Now listen, pyrrole disorder is a disorder of what we call oxidative stress and inflammation. It is a disorder of mood dysregulation. It is a disorder that is sensitive to stress. How many of us on planet Earth don't have stress? Mm-hmm. At some point in time in life, all of us have likely been through pyral disorder. As Nika, as you brought out before, individuals who tend to be genetic, that's a different story, but the ones who may be acute, they're handled a little bit differently. Yes, you have it now, it may resolve, but you may be waiting later on to have it again. These individuals, caution, caution, caution about what you do and how you treat. But I need you to understand this. We're here talking about autism. The vast majority of children with autism have pyral disorder.
Yeah.
So when you give them an omega-3, you have to be cautious. Now, here is one example where we say specifically cod liver oil. Specifically cod liver oil may be given to a child with autism. It's very beneficial. It's high and rich in vitamin A. The discussion around vitamin A and what it does in autism is another time, another story. But that's why we are okay with cod liver oil per se, but not okay with just random omega-3 supplements, okay? Omega-3 fish oils. Very, very different issue. And we still treat with omega-6s. That's the one small exception to the rule. So please understand me, all of you listening. That is an exception to the rule of pyral disorder. It is not the law with regard to pyral disorder, okay? Generally, omega-3s are not good. They're not your friends when you have pyrals. One exception is the possibility of autism.
And strangely enough, it is also not super beneficial to do fasting, which I wanted to mention because there might be some older children, teenagers, adults with autism listening to this. Why is that correlated as well? Why is there caution around that?
Forgive me, I'm going to ask you to repeat the first part. I didn't quite hear it. Fasting?
Fasting and pyral disorder. Why is that normally not a good combination?
Well, any kind of stress on the human body or the human mind increases pyrals, okay? And when you increase pyrals, that increases your incapacity to deal with stress. Fasting is a tremendous stressor on the system. But that's a very interesting point. Let's talk about why people would fast in many different cultures in order to reach higher enlightenment, to hear from the gods, to increase your sensitivity and awareness. You would fast first. When you fast, you increase your pyrals. When you increase your pyrals, you become more sensitive to light, to sound, to odors, to textures, smells. All of your senses are indeed heightened. Now, most of us are not trying to reach a spiritual enlightenment, you know, every day of our lives. And many of us are also not in a state where we need to have heightened sensitivity to light or odors or sounds or textures. Now, when we talk about our children with autism, what do you know about them? They're very sound sensitive. We also know that they smell everything. They may even come up to you and smell you. They're very texture sensitive in many cases. All of these things are part of pyral disorder, okay? So when you fast, you do indeed become more sensitive, but that could be a very big problem for those individuals who are light sensitive, for those who are tactile sensitive, for those who maybe they have morning nausea, as many pyrolytics do. So any given smell in the house can make them want to throw up. Okay, fasting is not always such a good idea. Okay, you have to know why and who it is you're talking about. So be very, very cautious with fasting. In the right environment, that's one thing. But if you've got pyral disorder and challenges, that's a whole different game.
So the last thing I wanted to cover around this whole food is important, diet is important, is food intolerances. So with my own child, I could see him go from being apathic, looking like this might sound extreme, but like a heroin addict, gone just like a zombie, to someone who was on speed, literally on the ceiling, just out of control. What is it, especially with dairy and gluten, food intolerances, and these morphine-like things that's going on in the bloodstream. Can you explain that so that a seven-year-old can understand?
Sure. And, you know, you kind of already hinted at it, Ninka. When you have dairy and casein and gluten, for example, they create a literal morphine-like effect in the brain. In fact, they hit the same receptor sites in the brain as morphine drugs. So they produce a form of high, if you will, or an intensification that can be very, very problematic. So when you say your child looks like an addict, they basically were. Those morphine-like effect, they're called exorphins, not endorphins, where you get the wonderful runner's high, if you will, but exorphins that produce challenges and difficulties because of the consumption of dairy and gluten. The system can't process those things in some individuals. And so they have this morphine-like effect, but instead of calmness and being happy, you're extremely excitatory and problematic, or depressed and rageful, or your mood just changes back and forth very, very rapidly. It is like somebody is turning into a mad person,
yeah,
and they're not rational anymore. And that can happen with food sensitivities. In fact, it is very well understood by us now, 7% of schizophrenia is actually due to a food sensitivity.
Wow.
Many individuals who have developed schizophrenia, it's actually because they had a food intolerance that they didn't know they had. Not the majority of people, so don't send me messages saying, you said that schizophrenia is caused by food. I didn't say that. I said certain proteins, certain foodstuffs, like casein, dairy, certain things can actually produce schizophrenia in a small population. But in autism, what we see is that children have a hard time processing these things in about 60% of the autistic population. So instead of being useful and getting calcium from your dairy, it produces this exorphin, ugly morphine-like effect.
That is so important. I think and I hope that parents who have been listening to this get an idea of how complex, but also how much hope that complexity offers. So how complex the situation is, but also how much hope is linked to just imagining addressing all these different irritants that individually create this chaotic biochemical situation, neurological situation in your child. So just to end this conversation, I remember in the old days when I was traveling the world trying to take my child to all these different experts, there was this one expert on heavy metals and detoxification. One expert that would only deal with the neurological part. One gut expert. And it was just so overwhelming because every expert was a huge expense and things I needed to learn as a parent. You uniquely combine all these things into one approach where you test and you address all of these issues. So in short, when someone comes to you, what is going to be addressed? What are parents going to walk away with? They're not going to get anywhere else.
The number one thing that's going to be addressed is your child. Your child, not your neighbor's child, not the person who gave you a recommendation, your child. Your child is unique. Your child has special talents, special gifts, special challenges. Number one, they have to be identified. And then we look at how to treat based upon that identification. Listening to what it is that a parent has to say is the most important thing that any doctor can do. If you come across an individual who doesn't seem to listen to you, you're in the wrong place, and it doesn't matter if it's autism or depression or anxiety. Find that person who will listen, because you will basically tell them, whether they know it or not, what's going on. Then we have to have the right testing. The testing needs to be time-tested, researched, true, and have consistent results that you can teach anyone. That's any physician, any practitioner.
Yes. Okay.
And that's the methodology that we use. We train doctors all over the world to use this kind of a methodology, okay? But now, of course, as a family practice physician, Dr. Bowman and I are both very interestingly beneficial in that we look at everything from a big global perspective. We're not looking at this just as a pediatrician. We're not looking at this as an internist. We're not looking at this as any of the other subspecialties. We're combining all of them. And that's not to say that other people, other specialties, don't have good capacity or power. What I'm sharing with you is simply what it is that we do and how we do it. But the most important thing is looking at your child, looking at your family dynamics, looking at family history, taking all this into account with testing, understanding which tests are useful and which ones are not. Ninka, we don't do thousands of tests and we pray that something is going to be wrong that we can fix.
No.
We look at very specific tests that we know are usually the key problems involved. And then we go with correction and guidance from there.
And that, I can just say, because I see a lot of practitioners and I see the best in the field and I network with them as well. And just this year of traveling around the world and especially in the US, I have met so many when I sit down and say, this is what's going on, this is what is feeling, they looked, even the best of them, so surprised and some of them embarrassed. So just to let everybody know, this is cutting edge. It's going to be implemented on a broader scale. That's what I predict, because it's so important and it's so effective. So thank you so much for offering hope and for coming from a true place of wanting healing for families. I know you are a man of faith and I have seen your genuine care for these people and these children and for really making a difference in this world. So I'm honored to have brought this to everybody and I'm sure this will literally be life-changing for anyone.
Thank you for having me, Ninka. I appreciate the opportunity to just share that there's hope.
Yes.
Don't give up. There's hope. Be that stubborn parent, just like Ninka was.
So I really hope you enjoyed this podcast episode. And if you did, I would like you to again press subscribe, like this video, because it really means a lot to me in order for me to be able to share this message. There are not a lot of people talking about turning symptoms around. There are so many practitioners out there, so many diets, so many biomedical experts who are making children worse every single day. And I'm working to try and stop that by spreading this news and by making sure that the right information gets to the right people. So if you like and subscribe and share this video, you can help me do that. You can also go to my website, barefootautismwarriors.com, and download one of my freebies to get started with these steps immediately today. Why wait? How long are you going to wait with these symptoms? How long are you going to live with this? What about the future? Are you not worried about your child's independence? Are you not ready to turn every stone like Dr. Mensah mentioned in this interview? I think you are. If you're watching this, I think this is a sign that you need to get started. So send me an email, contact@barefootautismwarriors.com. If you are a proactive mom, if you can't bring yourself to send an email, or if you're procrastinating on that, I know you're not the right one for this type of work because it will require so much more from you. But I hope to see you on my podcast again soon. Maybe you get ready later on, maybe next year. But no matter what, I hope you enjoyed this podcast and that you will subscribe to my newsletter to make sure you don't miss another episode, because this is the type of stuff that I'm sharing always. Thank you for watching.